This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Testing Show. As always, I'm your host, Matt Hoiser, and this week we are joined by Dan Billing, a software security penetration test specialist at New Voice Media. Did I get that right, Dan?
My actual job is senior test engineer, but I lead the security testing at this business, yes.
I got to meet Dan. You were presenting in Estonia a couple years ago, and then we ran into each other in Test Bash. Dan's based in the UK. I'm going to get this wrong. Is it near Cambridge?
Actually, I live in Somerset, a place called Frome. It's near Bath in the southwest of England. But my office is in Basingstoke, which is in the south in Hampshire. Cambridge is way over in the east, and Dan Ashby lives there, so lots of testers live that way.
I was going to go for a coincidence because we're joined by a couple people from our usual cast today. Percy Ababa is joining us from Cambridge, Maryland, so there was at least one Cambridge in there. Welcome back, Percy.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
And Justin Warman, of course, is from Nashville, Tennessee.
Morning.
And this week, we are recording without Michael Larson. He is out in Philmont, New Mexico, hiking in the woods with his Boy Scout troop. And we may have to do a few of these episodes. He's going to be gone a couple of weeks.
He's a scout leader, did you say?
Yep.
A coincidence? So am I.
Hey, not to tangent too much, but I was a Star Scout, and I believe just in life.
That's right. I just missed Eagle by the project.
Wow, you had all the merit badges and everything. Man, that's wow.
I had the project in progress, too. I just couldn't put it all together.
Wow, that's rough.
Yeah, it is.
We do it slightly differently here, but yeah, that's for another podcast.
Well, let's get started with some of the news of the day. The first thing I wanted to talk about was this 30 days of testing challenge put out by a Ministry of Test, which is Rosie Sherry's umbrella organization that also runs Test Bash. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes. And every day there's something new. Buy a book. You can listen to a podcast. You can take a picture of your office and put it up on media. I think it's just fantastic to get people to seriously commit to their profession for 1 month. It's not asking too much. And really, Ministry of Testing is really UK, Europe, more than US, or at least started that way. They have conferences in the US now, too. So, Dan, tell us a little bit about 30 Days of Testing. I think you're a little more involved with it than I am.
I've been following the news over Twitter. Myself particularly, so far, I've managed to complete at least two or three. We're into, like, day 12, I think, now. Last week, I create a mind map of some testing you were doing, or, as you say, listen to a podcast. So I listen to a security podcast called the Silver Bullet Podcast. Oh, I read a new book. So I read Dear Evil Tester by Alan Richardson, which is basically a set of anecdotes and answers to questions he's received over social media or email or at conferences. And he's kind of brought those together into a semi-humorous journey through his experiences in testing and the answers he's given to those questions. It's quite an insightful book and exciting read. It's quite a slim read, so it's not super detailed, but the book was very funny. But the real thing that I've noticed with the 30 Days of Testing Challenge is that it's really captured the imagination of testers and testing around the world. So I'm really excited by that. You know, I've been to every Test Bash for the last 4 years and applied to go to both of the American Test Bashes as a speaker, but failed on both occasions, sadly. But I spoke at the last Test Bash. One of the things that I'm really impressed with Ministry of Testing is its ability to reach out to testers, whether you're new to testing or whether you're an old hand, a veteran. And I probably consider myself a veteran now. So I've been doing this like 15 years, and there's still a lot to learn, even the length of time I've been doing testing. Challenges like this really engage. It really gets people excited.
Yeah, the book that I read is called The Obstacle is the Way, and it is a popular, easy-to-read, fun-read summary of Stoicism, the ancient Greek and later Roman philosophy. It's generally associated with just being tough and whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger, but the premise of The Obstacle is the Way is actually whatever you're struggling with right now, you can find ways to get that to inspire you to do better, to sort of slingshot you forward. Second major news item is this MRI scanning issue, and I thought maybe Justin could talk about that for a minute.
So a article came out in the .co.uk version of Wired. fMRI software, the software you use when you go to a doctor and you lay down on this bed and they slide you inside of a machine and rotate this big magnet around your head. So it has three different kinds of software in the MRI machines. Each of these was found to have a false positive rate of up to 70%, meaning that maybe it showed some kind of attribute for cancer or some kind of brain abnormality, and it was wrong 70% of the time when it did that. Aside from giving people false diagnoses, the software bug is invalidating about 15 years of medical research.
So if you look at this from a regulation perspective, there's multiple classes of medical devices. So the class 3 is the highest one, where there's more rigorous validation required. It's not just the hardware, but the software that comes with it as well. So I found out that there are some parts within an MRI device where some of it are actually classified as class 3 and some of it are marked as class 2. And then all of them has to go through this, what we call the 510K process, which is your pre-market approvals. It's like our staging server, so to speak, right? So the biggest question that I really have here is that supposedly this should have went through all of that since 1976, when this was classified as a class 3. There should have been very specific quality gates that whoever wrote this algorithm that should have gone through those, and they were given the burden of proof to not just only prove that it works according to how it was designed, but what the false positives are going to be. That's the biggest question that I have at this point. How did it take this X number of years before we realize, and now we've affected, what, 40,000 or so research papers? And not just that, but you're looking at a 70% more false positives. I mean, can you imagine?
So I guess to get real clear about the false positive real quick, let's say that there were two patients, one had Parkinson's disease and one did not have it. So if you send both of them through the MRI machine might end up saying that both of them are showing this attribute of people that have Parkinson's disease. According to the scan, you never know which is correct.
So it seems to me that they tested the software to see if it matched the algorithm, but didn't actually go back and test to see if that matched real users for both problematic users and a control group.
Right, hunting only for the ways that it's supposed to work instead of the ways that might fail.
Maybe we should segue here to talk about security testing, which is why we have Dan, right?
Yeah.
So Dan, I believe you started as, and I'm really interested in these kind of lateral shifts, tester to business analyst, pretty easy. Tester to developer. Maybe you got to go take some CS courses, but it's relatively straightforward. Security testing specifically seems like a black art that is not talked about much. And the difference between I'm an amateur and I know how to do the attacks, and I'm a professional and I can certify your e-commerce application, there's a big gap there.
I need a little bit of history here. So about 2008 or 9, I was working on applications that were going to be sold to our police services in the UK. You know, they were buying criminal investigation software or anything to do with managing payment of fines and issuing tickets. Speeding fines, for example, if you got caught speeding, either by an officer in person or via a camera. And I was working on those kinds of systems for about 2 or 3 years. And one of the things that came up in the requirements documents, and we had lots of traditional requirements documents, was the non-functional requirements, and security was generally listed there. And when I sort of questioned why aren't we doing the security testing, or what security testing are we going to do, that was generally put to one side, says, okay, we're not going to touch that because, one, we don't have the skills in-house, and two, we don't have the time to do it right now. So it would generally be left to the last minute, or it would be done by an external company. And that's generally been the pattern for a lot of companies for many, many years, that they would bring in an external resource to assist with that. So a consultancy that would help you do it. The security, I feel, is doing something internal to your business. And penetration is essentially someone trying to get through the doors from the outside in. And I'm generally working from the inside. So around 2010, I went freelance for a few years, and then I ended up here at New Voice Media. I've basically spent the last 3 years, give or take, training myself in various security testing techniques, learning about the theory of security through attending conferences and speaking to people and reading documentation, looking at the OWASP material that's out there. So I don't know whether you guys are aware, but OWASP is the Open Source Web Application Security Project, and they have a lot of free resources for learning. They help you train yourself to do this kind of thing, and also lots of frameworks and tools to help you as well. So that's kind of where I was starting from, using what was out there available for free or very little money indeed, taking one or two classes as well, which would help me. And one of the best resources I've ever hooked onto is the video training courses that are available on the training site Plural site, which are crafted by the security expert Troy Hunt. So I follow his blog quite carefully and learn a lot from him, from his videos and his training.
So the security work is really a black box to me. I have no clue what it looks like. What is the day in the life of a security tester?
So for me at the moment, I consult into all the other feature teams in my organization. So they are building new products, new services for our customers. Before, I was actually in one of the feature teams that was doing a lot of security work, but now a newly formed security team. That means that I come along and I'm invited to work alongside the other developers and testers, show them good ways of working with security tools and security testing itself, techniques that they might want to use for their particular pieces of work, or if they're building new features and forms or other functionality, then I would support them in that regard. I would spend time researching particular issues. You know, if we found a particular problem, I would look into that for them and share the knowledge with them. I also do training and facilitate learning both from a paired point of view with other testers, but also large groups and workshops across the entire business. So a part of my role is not just the testing side of things, but also mentoring and education across the dev team and also in other areas of New Voice Media, you know, security awareness generally, as well as just the technical security.
One thing that I think is cool that's happening with the Agile movement is we're taking these ancillary roles, DBA and operations, and we're bringing them into the team, hiring. Part of my interview process is when people do exercises and they say they're done and they haven't even mentioned security. It's okay to say, do you want me to do security testing? I don't know. I haven't done the research. Usually someone at least have a conversation.
I'd agree with that, Matt. You may not have the knowledge or skills yet, but it's bringing that expectation that you have to think beyond the square that your project sits inside. And one of those things is security. And I think that there's a lot we can do. If we can knock off the top three very quickly to say, hey, we've tested for that. We've tested for SQL injection. We've tested for cross-site scripting. We've tested for broken authentication and session management. If you can do those top three, and that gives you immediately a level of comfort about your software, we aren't just testers, we're also project managers, we're also analysts, we become much more operationally aware, you know, understanding architecture and things like that, and security is very much a part of that now. And it's something that we're looking to do in New Voice Media, is have security as part of DevOps or part of dev embedded heavily inside it. It becomes second nature.
I think that's great. Now, there are other things we can do when it comes to pen testing. There are scanners you can run against the website that comes back with the version of Linux it is on, the version of WordPress it is on, all of the little things. And then you can go Google, hey, WordPress 12345.72, what are the security holes?
There are lots of ways you can do that, Matt. You're quite right. So, for example, one of the tools I use quite heavily is one of the OWASP tools called Zattack Proxy. Like a lot of proxy tools like Fiddler, it sits between the browser and the server and it observes all the requests that are going through the browser. But then it will allow you to spider that website or the application you're testing to find new pages. It will allow you to do an active or passive scan against that application. And then it will allow you to do more detailed stuff like testing for something called cross-site request forgery. And it has a whole bunch of its own built-in heuristics. One of the great things about it is that you can include it in your CI. It has a lot of integrations with things like Jenkins, and you can script it up in Python or Ruby or whatever flavor of code you enjoy. I've been learning Python and Java myself recently, so that's been very helpful. There are ways you can incorporate a lot of these tools in. You mentioned port scanning. There's one called Nmap. There's a whole bunch of others that if you watched any of the Bourne movies or The Matrix and they have a green screen on it coming up with lots of strings of data, that's generally Nmap they've been using.
Did not. Yeah, that. That's cool.
Yeah, they generally take a screenshot of Nmap running on the, in the background because it looks kind of cool. It looks like code. It's just a port scanner, and it looks kind of awesome. I think it was definitely in one of the Bourne movies and definitely in The Matrix. So I don't know whether it's turned up anywhere else, but yes, because green is, of course, it's all about security. One of the things I would like to sort of counter would be the dark art thing, Matt. What I want to try and do is enable testers to be able to incorporate this stuff into their work day to day. Do that internally in my business. I've written a plugin for a tool called Bug Magnet. You guys must know Goiko Ajdic. He did Specification, by example, that book. But he also wrote a tool called Bug Magnet, and you can customize Bug Magnet. Just incorporate a JSON file into Bug Magnet, and you can customize it. It's got some cross-site scripting filter evasion techniques built into it rather than the standard techniques that are supplied by the tool. So I can do that, and I can add SQL injection to it. So I can leave the tool to go away and do something and then alert me that if there's a problem, come back. I've also got, you know, some simple ways of incorporating the nasties into my testing every day. One of the things I have to be aware of, though, is that security isn't everything. You have to have it in balance with all the other things we've talked about: performance, usability, accessibility. There's no point having an application that's so secure that no one can log into it and use it. You need to still make it usable and accessible to people, as well as being protecting their data and your customers' data and the business data from attack. I just want to highlight one thing that happened last year. In the UK, there was an attack on a broadband supplier, telephony supplier for the home called TalkTalk. And the attackers were not professionals by any sense of the imagination. They weren't nation states. They weren't professional cyber criminals. They were just a bunch of people at home playing with security tools that they found on the internet. There was a denial of service attack against TalkTalk, so they launched a multiple requests against their portal, and then they used that denial of service to distract TalkTalk from the SQL injection that was going on. And then they used a tool, supposedly a tool called SQL Map, to do the actual attack and steal the data of God knows how many customers. And they've lost something like, I think it's in the region of between 30 to 60 million pounds worth of business as a result, you know, wow, in lost revenue. And it's quite a small fry for a lot of businesses. They could probably absorb a lot of the cost, but the reputational damage was huge. They've lost a lot of reputation here in the UK, that company. I follow a blog called hackmageddon.com, and that has a timeline of the most recent significant attacks, the sorts of data that was stolen, and the types of attacks that were used. And it's a fairly good indication of the types of things that are happening out there in the real world and where the attacks are coming from based on the IP address of the attacker. So they can tell you where the attack was coming from inside the US or from Europe or from Russia or China or North Korea or wherever. So, and most of the traffic does go between Russia and China and the United States. There are some attacks coming to and from Europe, but most of the traffic is between China, Russia, and the United States. So there are various hack maps you can see.
Yeah, you know, I believe a lot of like CDNs actually have this feature too now, where they can actually look into, they plug in like a web application firewall in between for all of their web properties, and then you can actually see where the threats are coming. And then based on the country data, you can look at from where it's coming from and where it's going to, and then you can then create like a visual model of it.
If you can visualize it in a way that's exciting to people, it actually engages them more with the problem, I believe. And the maps are a really good way of doing that.
For what it's worth, I totally agree with that. I think I've said this before, maybe on this podcast, in that I never got mind maps. I had a really hard time with mind maps for a long time. Everyone's like, mind map for the new hotness. They're a way to represent test ideas. It's fine. I don't have a problem with representing test ideas or brainstorming now. I'm pretty good with the bulleted list. And then I saw the value they have in communicating and visualizing what you're doing for other people. And I imagine it's the same thing with the attacks. Like, wow, there's a lot here. We should probably do something about how many of those land in Cambridge, Maryland, or Hampshire, England. That in and of itself is just a powerful message to create a conversation. So in the case of mind maps, the conversation is about what are risks we're not worried about, what are risks we don't think are worth investing in, what are the risks we are worried about, and they actually change the conversation from 0 to 1, binary, you're done or you're not done, when you're going to get done, to, oh, there's an infinite number of ideas here if you're triaging your time.
I find that mind mapping actually helps me a great deal when I'm trying to explore an application for the first time from a security point of view, because it allows me to see visually the different layers, pages sit under what pages, what functions sit under which pages and functions, and then also how I can link sets of data together with the page itself. So I know what tables are being queried. I can then perhaps structure an attack based on, can I create data or delete data through SQL injection, for example. You know, visualization really helps me there. And actually, when I come to do training internally, I use mind mapping to structure the responses back from the team and link them together. So I find it a very useful tool. And it's not just for security, but, you know, it doesn't suit everybody, but it does suit me.
Let's switch a little bit and talk about other aspects of security, like simulating a phishing attack to see who will click on it, handing out USB sticks in the parking lot to see who will stick in the computer, calling people up and pretending to be the help desk and trying to get their password.
So what you're talking about here is social engineering?
Social engineering is definitely in there. They're all ways of changing the attack surface from a technical one to a social one. I guess so, yeah.
I did a small workshop at Let's Test in Sweden earlier this year on social engineering. What that focuses on is the weakest link in any system or piece of software or service is the human being, either the human being that built it or the human being that's using it. You used a couple of examples there, phishing attacks. They're quite easy. It's quite easy to craft a malicious email and send it out. I've heard of it being done inside companies to see who's paying attention to security warnings and emails and things like that. Who's clicking on what, and are they just ignoring warnings about what they're doing? Are they checking the URL that they're being passed through to? Are they actually sending data they shouldn't be sending? That kind of thing. And then the dropping USB sticks. People will pick that up and not think twice about sticking a USB stick into their computer, because they think, oh, look, it's free USB. Let's find out what's on that. Is it got some cool stuff on there? Is there something I can sell? Or using people's often, I hate to say it, self-interest and sometimes greed, also their lack of knowledge. Quite often, it's often people preying on vulnerable people as well. For example, telephony type social engineering. Sales people use it legitimately to generate sales and secure sales wins all the time. So they say, hey, we've got this awesome product. We think it will work for you. And they're using social engineering techniques to get you to get interested in and buy their product. It's the same when someone's trying to get you to divulge information about yourself or your business. So someone comes up to the receptionist at your building and says to them, hey, I've got a package for X and Y, and they look like a legitimate delivery person. Or they get the person who the package is intended for is to come to reception and sign for it there. What they shouldn't be doing is letting those people into the building. Let's say, for example, you've got decorative plants in the building to make the place look nice. And you might have come someone in who comes in to tend those. And then they could be looking around looking for things to steal or information to gather. Equally, it could be the guy or the lady coming in to repair the printer. Social engineering is a major problem, and I think will become more of a problem because the web is increasingly the way we communicate. So, you know, it's something we all need to be aware of, but I don't want everybody to be so frightened that they don't want to go out their front doors. You know, we still need to go out and interact with people and be part of communities that we live in. We shouldn't be afraid of learning about the world out there just because there might be people out there that want to harm us. I can point you to some great resources on social engineering. I think it's socialengineer.org. There's some great work by chaps like Christopher Hagnaggy and Kevin Mitnick. Every year in, I think it's Las Vegas, they have DevCon, where they do social engineering hacks as teams.
So you've done this testing. You did the OWASP thing. Maybe you go to a conference or two. Maybe you go to Black Hat. Maybe you take some training. You learn how to use Zetattack proxy. You learn how to use the port scanner tools, figure out the products that are running on the server, and then go after those. As an internal person, how do you get the confidence? When do you know that you can say, based on an audit using known security flaws and standard pen testing methodology, we believe that this company has provided sufficient evidence that their security is acceptable for financial regulations to sign on it?
My organization is PCI compliant, but it takes a lot of work for us to get there. We have quarterly scans that we have to do. I run my security scans on a weekly basis. Different organizations will identify different levels of risks for themselves. So if you're talking about financial organizations, they're insured up to the hilt, but they also have a lot of regulations that cover them. I think that the world of security testing, security specialists have pitched themselves at the compliance regimes that are supplied to you. So, we've mentioned PCI, but there are a whole bunch of others like SOC and SOC 2 to do with finances, and HIPAA, which is a US one to do with health data. You know, we under European law, data protection law, and then we also have our own data protection law in the UK. So we have to be subject to multiple different levels of scrutiny. As long as you can provide evidence that you've done the testing that you've said you'd do, and that testing is adequate or more than adequate to describe the testing that was done. And the problem is that a lot of people think that once you've done the security testing, that your application's 100% secure. That's a fallacy. It's never going to be. That's why I generally follow frameworks like Stride, for example, as a threat modeling process devised by Microsoft for identifying threats to systems. OWASP have the OWASP ASVS, and it can sit inside or alongside any of the compliance regimes that you have. One of the things we are a challenged as testers, and not just as security, is making sure we answer to our businesses in terms of demonstrating the work that we've done to ensure that the quality is there. And one aspect of that is security. And I think it's always going to be a challenge for us as testers to do that. And people have been talking about it ever since I've become a tester in 15 years and far, far longer. We hear about breaches and attacks much more often on the web, and it's becoming much more in people's radars. I think we need to be much more aware of it than we were. I mean, I'll say this now. If anyone who's doing 30 days of testing wants to come and, you know, spend time with me, talking to me on Skype or hooking up at a meetup or something like that to learn about security, then, you know, all they have to do is email me or find me on Twitter. And they can do that, and I will happily talk to them about it and share my thinking and ideas and techniques with them.
What approaches have you had in actually communicating security issues in context? Is there a scoring system that we can look at for the vulnerability so that everybody can have a base understanding on what's important, what's not important?
So there's a number of things that you can use to help gauge that, Pizzy. There's the OWASP Top 10, which is the top 10 web application vulnerabilities. If you're hitting all those top 10, then you can have some confidence. But that's just web applications. There's also an OWASP Top 10 for mobile applications. And there's also the CVE Top 25 as well. You can test for stuff that's beyond the OWASP Top 10, like remote code execution, which is quite a challenge. The Application Security Verification Project, Verification Standard Project, so OWASP ASVS, and it has different levels of security checking that you can do. Unlike, say, for example, ISO standards and things like that, it's entirely voluntary. So you can pick and choose the bits that work for you, and that gives you kind of a stage one, stage two, stage three being the hardest to achieve. One of the things I have done, apart from running various meetups and talks and workshops, is I created Monomic, which helped me when I first started security testing. As some of my friends and colleagues know, I'm a big Doctor Who fan. And in that show, they have a villain called the Daleks, who are a cybernetic race of aliens, and their battle cry is exterminate. So I use that word to help me build a mnemonic for security testing. It's a word I've known for a long time, thanks to that show, and it's a word that I won't forget. EX is explore, so using my exploratory testing techniques to help me find issues. T for threats, so it helps me identify the potential threats to an application. Experiment, so that's not just experimenting in terms of the testing that I'm going to do, but also tools and techniques, also any learning that I might have done, and trying those out to see how it works. So the next one is R for risk, identifying risks and managing risks. The M is monitor, not just from a testing point of view, but also from an operational point of view. The I and the N is interrogate, so asking deep, hard questions of your applications. Analysis, so that's understanding the data that comes back from a security scan, for example. You're going to have false positives and you're going to have actual bugs in there. So it's a case of finding the sorting the wheat from the chaff. The next one, the T, is targeted. So that is essentially aiming your testing at a specific target rather than allowing it to harm other areas without care and attention. And the last one is expedited. So the E is doing it quick. You know, there will always be someone running an attack somewhere, you know, from an automated system, or they're doing it up late at night or whatever. So as soon as a patch comes in from, say, Microsoft or wherever else, you need to quickly patch those and also identify where the vulnerabilities are if you're unpatched. And that's the mnemonic. I hope that's helpful. That's one quick way I found of visualizing and communicating security issues for testers and testing. That's it. Thank you, gents.
Okay, Dan, this has been great. But thanks, everybody, for coming. And we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
Right. See ya.
See ya. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.